Welcome to Folio, an actual play podcast about solo and epistolary TTRPGs. I'm your host, Seda, and my goal is to showcase multiple possible experiences of self-paced games by inviting guests to play them alongside me so I can compile our stories together. You can support the show financially at patreon.com/foliopod or join as a free member to get access to the bonus podcast feed. In a few days, that feed's going to get the edited audio-only version of last month's stream, which is always posted alongside the public release of the VOD. Today, we are continuing our games of Live, Love, Die, Remember, a game about mechs falling in love with their pilots, reliving their memories of love before the end, and the cost of victory by Ray Cox. With me again are Brianna Price and Dora Rogers. Check out their links in the episode description, particularly Dee's ongoing at the moment Kickstarter for Drink My Sweat, a bottoms-inspired storytelling game for queer women. Punch cuties, get messed up, fall in love, and be fucking hot. Funding now and throughout Zine Month, February 2025. Last week, we established the parameters of the war and saw the first things our mechs remembered about their relationships to their pilots as they sit in the stretched-out, frozen moment before the decisive action in their final battle. We join them, still in that moment, for more reminiscing.
Let's roll again. You know what? It's fun.
Give me another random number.
Let's roll for the second memory, and then let's make some lunch. Everyone, all together, no matter when you're hearing this, make some lunch. Okay, I rolled a 3 on my d4, so this is going to be the results from 21 to 30. Rolling my d10, I got a 6, so it's going to be 26. What you teased them about. Interesting. So the first thing I thought of was just they're like, that she has a kind of adorable outsized reaction to space travel. That, I mean, I don't know how many pilots I've worked with, but I imagine that there is some baseline expectation of how pilots should act that I am aware of or have programmed into me or something. And the fact that she is so like, not nonchalant about space in the way that most pilots would be, I think is quite endearing. I'm not sure if that's what I poke at. I think that what I might tease her about is it's her like mechanical special interest, right? Like we're doing surveillance. We're watching the enemy ace train a bunch of rookies from a distance, and she is getting very caught up in looking at the new hardware of the rookies, being like, oh my god, look at these manufacturing things that they've evolved, look at the ways that they've gotten better, look at the ways they've put this together, that kind of thing. And I think, again, in a slightly dangerous way, I sort of tease her about sedition. Like, tease her about having seditious thoughts, admiring the artillery of the enemy and suggesting in some way that their forces may be impressive in a way that ours are not. And this is genuinely alarming to her at first because it sounds a little bit like the type of thing that maybe I am genuinely programmed to watch out for. Like it would make sense if there was some sort of watchdog program inside of me that is trained to like check if a pilot is maybe gonna do treason, because like we're giving them a lot of power and a lot of agency in their giant killing machines, and so, you know, we just want to keep an eye on that, we just want to make sure that they're loyal. And so she's genuinely nervous, like, oh, I crossed a line and I'm about to be reported and get reprimanded, and then I push it a little farther, you know, like she clams up and she's like, well, no, of course, I think that this and this and this. And I just push it a little further where I turn it into more obvious of a joke, saying like, playing into the like, oh, you're looking at other girls type thing. Like, not literally that, but that's very much the tone. And she slowly realizes that I'm joking and relaxes and laughs super hard and gets much more open and enthusiastic about sharing her interest with me, and her enthusiasm like is very much like, oh, I can just talk about this now. Great. And I think quietly there is some part of me that's like, oh, this is also just very tactically advantageous. Like, you're excited, and it does mean that you are providing me with data that I can turn into something useful that might save our lives at some point. Or I think there's even part of me that is like preemptively defensive. Like, if someone else catches word that she talks like this, they might genuinely think that she's a problem. And so I am already analyzing the data and turning it into a report of like, actually, I think that you'll find that Pilot Cadaver was able to notice all of these things, and now we know better how to defeat this particular type of enemy, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's, I do some light teasing about their interest in mechanics being seditious thought.
28. Your first dance? Oh, wow. Oh, this is interesting. Your first dance. Because that could mean a few different things for a mech, right? Like, this could just mean us piloting, like, her piloting me. Or it could mean an actual dance in some way. There's this really cute thing in Gundam, The Witch from Mercury, where they... They're trying to, like, the characters are trying to sort of, they have the challenge of making this kind of scary mech technology kind of palatable to people. So they shoot this really silly video of the main character, Celetta, dancing and her mech doing the same dance next to her, which is just what I immediately thought of when I saw this prompt. But it's not that, but maybe it has a little of that goofy energy. So I think this started with Tamsin, okay. So back on our ship, back on the Firenze, they're on R&R, right? Like, they've been on the front lines for a long time, and they're getting their break, where they're docked at a big space station. The ship's being repaired, but there's not really anything to do on the space station. It's just like a, you know, glorified supply depot. So everybody's going a little stir crazy because we're just sitting on the ship, with like diminished duty. So, the commanding officers, and like, I think Tamsin was sort of like involved in this, as a senior officer, they decide to throw a dance. And they do it in the mech bay, this like huge open space where all of these giant robots are gathered so that they can be worked on. And I guess maybe the way that the space works is that there's kind of like scaffolding along the sides, and the mechs are all parked next to the scaffolding so that you can, like, you know, you can work on the, like, the pilots can climb in, people can work on the upper parts of the mech. Yeah. And there's a dance. And I think at this point, this was later, this is a good deal after the comet night. And this was, like, not, like, a recommended use case, necessarily. Tamsin had started leaving me on all the time, right? Like, I'm supposed to, like, you shut the mech off at when you're done with it. And the AI is basically asleep. And I think, like, you know, sometimes I do that because I can get bored. But often she would just leave me on because she started to think of me as a person, as a friend. So I'm on all the time now. And I'm just watching the dance. It looks fucking fun. I think there's probably a lot of different stuff that goes on at this dance, right? Like, there's probably actually, like, line dancing, because, you know, they want it to be sort of like a lighthearted team building thing. So there's a lot of that, which is, you know, I mean, line dancing can be a fucking blast. It's not like line dancing is tame. But later in the night, like, the music gets louder and more current, and the dancing gets kind of more chaotic. And I feel like, given that we're in kind of a forever war, there's, like, a degree to which relationships inside of the service are, like, you know, they're frowned upon. And obviously, like, you can't do it within a chain of command, so it's, like, you can't sleep with your superior officer, and it means, like, the captain is ultimately out of luck. But it's kind of tolerated for everybody else, right? Especially for more casual hookups. And there's a lot of, like, a lot of couples are going to leave this dance. Couples or larger groups are going to leave this dance and have fun in other ways, in different places. So the energy is very sexually charged. And Tamsin's right out there. I think that Tamsin doesn't, you know, she doesn't have a partner. There's nobody that she's going to slip away with, but she's a fucking hottie. She's this like gorgeous, very feminine. Like her hair is long. Like usually, of course, she has it up because she's in a military setting. But tonight her long hair is down. She's like small fat, very curvy, and just beautiful. And she's as glamorous as sort of like her condition, you being on this military ship will allow. Like she's like gone all out on her makeup. It's probably a way like I've never really seen her before, actually. And she's very popular. But she's kind of, I think partly because she's highly ranked, partly because she feels the burden of being one of the leaders on this station very keenly. She's just kind of, to some degree, not in the mood. Maybe a little bit, because there's somebody that she likes, even if she hasn't admitted it to herself. And that someone is me. She doesn't partner up, is what I'm saying. But she has a lot of kind of sexy dances with people. And I don't think I'm jealous of that. Well, I'm not jealous in the sense of, like, being jealous of Tamsin's attention. I think it doesn't occur to me to be, because even though I love Tamsin at this point, I know I can't be a partner to her in that way. Or I think that I can't be a partner to her in that way. I'm jealous that I can't dance with her. That's what I'm jealous about. I'm jealous that I can't dance. But I'm not jealous that other people like her or that she might like somebody else. And I think that that leads... that night, as the night winds down, and she sobered up because she probably wasn't sober the entire time, she comes to say goodnight to me. And it's kind of like, you know, oh, like, what did you think of seeing your first dance? And, I think I'm honest. I'm probably pretty guileless, really. You know, I'm probably pretty open about things. I just say, I say sort of what I just said, right? Except I don't, I think the one thing I will not say to her is that I love her, because it feels like too much to put on her. But I'll just say, like, it was amazing. I really enjoyed it. It was beautiful. It looked like so much fun. I really wish that I could dance like that. And I think she sort of gets sly, and there's not a lot of people around. And there's somebody has to be on duty, right? So I think she just climbs into the cockpit and seals the cockpit up and like calls to the flight controller or whatever, like, hey, I'm taking Adzi out. And they're like, why? Is this a patrol? And she's just like, don't worry about it. And they don't worry about it. Because it's Tamsin. It's Lieutenant, what did I name her? Lieutenant Commander Calder. And she gets what she wants. She probably has a call sign. I'll have to think about that. And we fly out into space. And I think it's a little experimental. She says something like, all right, so it takes two people to dance. So, I am going to control our maneuvering and you are going to control our thrusters. And she just, it's just kind of like, let's see what that's like. And it's interesting, actually. Like, it is, because it does give us both a lot of input, because I can, by increasing or decreasing our thrust, I can change our turning radius. I can turn a sort of gentle curve into a tight loop. By increasing or decreasing speed. And, you know, obviously she's ultimately, like, leading where we go. And it's fun. It's really fun. And I think it feels very intimate. And as we're going back to the ship, I say, is that what dancing's like? And she's kind of like, it's a very different kind of dancing than I've ever done before. But, yeah, I think that's kind of what dancing's like. And, and she parks me. We say goodnight, and she asks if I want to switch off for the night or not. I say no, and I just think a lot about dancing that night. I think a lot about dancing and about her. And I think I also think about the things that we don't have or don't do. And the biggest thing is touch, because I think the touching is a lot of what seems special to me about dancing. Yeah. I have to mark my chassis. Okay, I'm gonna draw like a really, I'm gonna draw like little stick figures, but I want you to know that this represents what she puts on my chassis after this, which is another stencil of this two women in silhouette, like dancing like crazy, like not touching, but like standing next to each other and just fucking like jamming out, like dance like nobody's watching style. Yeah. I think she puts that over my heart. The comment was on my arm.
20. When they told you what they fight for. Huh. They told me, I think we were training at this point. The thing about being what we were is that there was a lot of preamble before getting out there to try to kill the enemy ace. They didn't want the enemies to know what they had developed. My pilot was still frustrated, still felt that, I guess from my perspective, it seemed like she still felt like this was beneath her. This wasn't what she should be doing. But I wanted to understand why, because to me, there's nothing greater than the purpose we were built for. Or I guess I was built for. That we were made for. And so while we were in the midst of a simulation, I said, I always used to call her like Sergeant. I don't think she was a sergeant, but I always called her Sergeant, at least at first. Sergeant? Yes. Why do you feel this is beneath you? I never said I feel this is beneath me. Why do you think I think that? I'm sorry, I must have misunderstood. Why is this not what you wish to be doing? Because it's not what I signed up for. Don't you know what they're doing out there? How much have they told you? Tell me? Jesus, they haven't even told you. They just made you, huh? They just made you and that's just supposed to be good enough? I don't understand. I have purpose. I need nothing more than purpose. No, you don't have purpose. You have programming. You have rules imbued in you. I have purpose. I've seen what they did to us. I have seen the water get tainted, the crops rotting. I have seen the plague they unleashed upon the world to try to keep us in fucking line. I have seen why we fight. Why do you fight? Because once I had a family. Now I don't anymore. And she sort of, I don't know that I ever saw her cry, but I heard in her voice her stopping herself from crying. And she says, once I had a home and a family and a life, I used to fight like hell for us to get by. And eventually, they made it clear that us just getting by wasn't something they could allow, so now I'm here. And I'm here to kill as many of those motherfuckers as I can take. Is there something that you were going to say? No, damn it. Focus, let's get back to, we have work to do. We have work to do. Another tally.
the sunrise you watch together. I'm gonna skip that one because it feels a lot like watching a comet together. The one right above that on the list is how they helped you understand the weight of taking a life. Oh boy, that's really good. So I'm gonna do that. How do they help me understand the weight of taking a life? I think this was very early. This was close to the comet night, and because I think it's important for this that Tamsin start to have a sense of my emerging, like the fact that I am a person. And we go out into a really tough, crazy mission. You know, so the mission that I was designed for is attacking a fortress, right? So it's like, I'm like the heaviest of heavies. I go out into just like crazy amounts of fire, and I dish out a huge amount of punishment to bring down these really heavy defenses. I'm gonna say this happened on Earth. The Firenze can be on Earth, right? Like it can go through reentry, and it's got, you know, whatever magic anti-gravity technology. It can sort of like float over the landscape. This is very, very Gundam, of course. That technology is not strong enough to like get us. We couldn't escape Earth's gravity. So we deployed from the Firenze to this just like this massive fortress that was a key spot in defending like the coalition of Luna's holdings on Earth, right? Because I said before that they need like a source of water, air, like all of these things that we don't have on the moon necessarily. And this is a key, we're part of an offensive to sort of chip away at that territory. And we attack this huge fortress that they've built with walls and turrets and all of this very like sci-fi like stuff, like turrets like rise out of the ground and then descend into the ground so you can't take them out. And it's all laid out as this like, you know, so that you have to cross this field of fire, this like killing ground. And that's what we have to do. It's the AdZ, and I think the first production models are coming online at this point. So there are a few other AdZs with us. And Tamsin, as like the veteran and using this kind of model, she leads this mission across this this no man's land, this like open ground that's been created to destroy attackers. And I am taking heavy hits. But I'm designed to take heavy hits. And we achieve our mission. I think one of the ADSPs, you know, gets not destroyed, but like seriously damaged. I'm kind of picturing this as like it's like when tanks were first deployed in World War I, people didn't quite know how to use them. So, and they were kind of unreliable. So they would like break down in the middle of an offensive. So something sort of like that, right? Like one takes a hard hit in a weak point, like a joint, and it's kind of stuck in the middle of no man's land. But, you know, we were able to press on, and, you know, we get close enough that we're able to, like, I'm able to, like, unload this, I think it's on an integrated cannon, but, like, I'm very much drawing this from, Gundam Heavy Arms from Gundam Wing. It had this like huge cannon that it could sort of hold on to that it could then like drop. I've got this like huge cannon that I carry in my right hand that I can drop when I'm done with. Make it the left hand because I'm left-handed and I want it to be on my left hand. So I'm like laying down waste with this cannon, and like these huge shells are popping out, and like the plates are opening up in my chest, like armor's like poking open, and like a bunch of missiles fly out, and we just, yeah, like this team of ADSs is totally up to the challenge of this heavy fortress. And there's all of these explosions that are so satisfying for the viewers at home, and the mission is, you know, on the whole a huge success, and I think it's like a big vindication of Tamsin's work and the like the whole class of mechs, and like now there's going to be more ADSs. And in the aftermath of this, as like our infantry moves in and takes control of the fortress, all of the ADSs just get parked, you know, like once the area is clear, outside of the fortress. So we're all just standing there. And Tamsin goes inside and is... She's not, like, part of the assault, right? But, like, she goes and there's, like, a mobile command center set up. And she's getting debriefed. There, you know, now we have, like, fucking showers and dorms and stuff in this fortress. So she's probably, like, getting rest after this combat mission. And when she comes back, I think when we parted on this, like, really nice, in this really nice way where she was happy because we'd succeeded. And it was, like I said, it was a big vindication of, like, her investment in this project, like, this new model. Testing, you know, of piloting the experimental model and being successful on missions. And now our first sort of like big official mission is out of the way. We parted in this, like, she was really happy and she comes back and she's really tight lipped. And I think I, like, being very well meaning, am kind of, chipper. I'm kind of like, you know, like, oh, like, were the generals happy? Like, I'm, you know, I'm sort of, like, burbling all of these excited questions. And she is very short with me. And eventually, well, I mean, yeah, I think I'm just hurt. And she sort of has this, like, I get very robotic, right? I'm just, like, this is how I deal with being hurt. I'm just kind of, like, I start, like, only answering her queries and with, like, you know, like, a monotone. And, oh gosh, what's my voice like? I think she, you know, like, she obviously interacts with me in, like, the function of the mech and, like, the actually piloting me. And there's a lot of, like, you know, I'm, like, powering her heads-up display and all of the information on her that shows on her system. But I also just have a voice and we just talk. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think it has a Siri quality, right? It's just this kind of, like, it's mostly this kind of pleasant woman's voice, but she has noticed that I have a lot more range of expression than she expected, that I can sound worried or sad or hurt. Yeah, but usually, like, when I feel hurt, usually I don't sound it. Usually I get very withdrawn, and I just try to be like a machine who doesn't mean to take up space from you. So I think what she does is we just have to return to Firenze, but she takes a detour and goes to one of the outlying fortifications, this big turret that we destroyed. And it's like an old battleship turret. When I was a kid, I remember touring like a battleship, like a World War II era battleship. And they had, you know, these huge steel turrets that were fully enclosed. And she brings me over to something like that. Where it's like a, you know, a big gun sticking out of a big cylinder. And we blew this thing up. And she, using my hands, she rips this thing open so that we can see inside. And there's a gun crew. You know, there were people in this turret making it work. And when we destroyed it, they all died. And I'm kind of like, why are you showing me this? And she's really angry. And she's not really angry at me. I think at this moment she is angry at me because she's angry that I don't understand this thing that is really important to be in person, which is that we did harm. And I think she just, like, you know, I'm looking at the bodies of these people, and she is just like, they were all like me. No, you know what? She says, they were all like you or me. They were all people. They all thought about the future. This is right after the comment things. They all thought about what they were going to do after the war, and we killed them. And, you know, I'm sort of, I'm like, but it was our mission. They were the enemy. And she says, yeah, and they were people. Now they're dead. And I think I have a lot, I don't say anything at that moment. I think I just get quiet, and we're both quiet for a long time. And then she goes, she drives us back to base. It's a long time. I don't think we ever talk about it. I don't think I'm ever like, I was thinking about that time you showed me the bodies in the turret, but I think about it a lot because I think in a lot of ways, this is not just how I learn about death, but it is how I learn about ambiguity. Because I have to deal with the fact that we did the right thing. We followed our programming, quote unquote, in my terms, we did the assignment. and there was something wrong with that. And yeah, like I said, we never talk about it, but I think eventually Tamsin, like, it becomes clear to Tamsin over time that I did think about it and that I did learn a lesson from it. Yeah. So it is a big moment in our relationship. I'm going to mark my chassis with something that's a symbol of hope. I think it's a symbol of hope for Tamsin that she won't have to fight forever. And I think the symbol she chooses, it's a shuttle. It's a, it's like a civilian craft. So it's like sleek. It has kind of like a space shuttle. It has like little wings for when it has to maneuver in atmosphere. It's got some maneuvering fins. And it's just like a civilian ship for moving people around the moon, moving people like around the solar system, which is the kind of thing she wanted to fly before the war. It's done. The one that I drew on my arm isn't like this, but it's done in this very cool style, right? So like people won't see it necessarily and think this is kind of a protest against the war. They'll think like, oh, she's like kind of bragging that she's a cool pilot. She loves flying and is so skillful, but she knows what it means. And I think I maybe don't initially know what it means, but eventually I do. Maybe this is the first, because this is before she stencils the dancing women on me. I think this is the first time she introduces color. So I'm like very gray. The comet she did in white, and the shuttle is in it's in white, purple, and yellow. And it's the first splash of color on my chassis. And I think that the women were a deep blue against like a pink background that was part of the stencil. So I get more colorful over time.
I made a sandwich. And check this out. It's a caffeinated soda, baby. Let's get wild. It's been in my fridge for ages because I can't really do caffeine like I used to now that I'm properly medicated and 100 years old. Let's roll. Let's roll for a prompt. All right, I rolled a 2, so this is going to be from 11 to 20, and a 4. So, 14, the storm you got caught in. Ooh. So, I think probably because I was just talking about them doing a stakeout, I think that what this is that we are like behind enemy lines in some way, and the storm is an electrical storm of some kind, or some sort of like space phenomena that essentially makes it very difficult to, or it makes it essentially impossible or very, very, very dangerous to take off, to leave. And I think there is interference on planet as well, like definitely messing with electrics. And I think it's the kind of thing where it's like, we have no idea if they'll discover us, like we've been spying or sabotaging or doing something, and we're supposed to just leave because we could be discovered. Maybe that's what it is. Ooh, yeah, I'm gonna say that it was a sabotage mission specifically. And again, all of this has to be very focused on the like defeating the ace. Like that's what I'm good at. But this was like going behind enemy lines and, oh, it was like destroying spare parts. The enemy ace has like a very unique custom mech that runs in part off of like very old parts they don't make anymore. And they've been slowly like building a hoard of backups so that they can keep going for as long as possible. And we had the mission that we were on was to go in and just destroy those backups, or as many of them as we can. And we go in and we do that. And as we are going to escape, this huge storm comes up. And so we're trapped and we have no idea. Like, we don't know if alarms went off, if they already know we're here, if they're going to come find us. Kind of our only hope is that the storm is also fucking with them, which, like, enough that they won't be able to get to us. if they even know we're here, and maybe they don't. And I think we're also trying to look on the bright side and being like, maybe it will look like the storm did this. Like, if they don't know that we're here, if none of the alarms went off, if they didn't have any hidden sensors, it could look like this wasn't intentional sabotage, that this was just a random act of nature. And that's always good, just any leg up, right? Like, if they found it and knew that it had been sabotaged, then they would know that we knew, which means that they have a leak somewhere, or that we have like a pipeline of information that they weren't previously aware of. So it could be good, but we have to live in that uncertainty for several hours on this planet. We're like hidden under a cliff. The horde was in some like industrial warehouse in the middle of nowhere type of thing. And we are like, we can't get that far away, but we're trying to not be directly there, but there's not a lot of cover, and trying to hit the balance between hiding somewhere in limited cover and not hiding in the only place that they would look because it's the only cover. And we just have to sit there and we can't relax. Like, this can't be like, ah, the storm's happening, we can't do anything, oh well, it's out of our hands, let's kind of chill. We have to be on high alert the entire time. We have to be watching the storm. We have to be like trying to see if anybody is coming to us. We have to be scanning to see if anyone is near, if they've discovered us, anything that we can pick up. And so it's very high tension and long. And I think there is a moment where I raise the idea that this is only really dangerous for me. Like, it wouldn't be pleasant for a human to walk out there, especially, I'm sure that a lot of these humans are like quite augmented. It wouldn't be pleasant, but it would be possible, and that she could get out and go and find another way off planet, or at least hide farther away from me. That's part of it too, is like, I'm way easier to find than she would be if she were on her own. And so she could go, and first I suggest leave the planet, and she's like, nope. And then I'm like, okay, well, you could at least, I've been, you know, I have some maps that from scanning from before the storm came up and interfered with all of that. You could go and you could hide here. This is a place that a human would fit. They'd never find you. I won't fit. And she's like, no. And just like a few moments of that, a conversation where she just repeatedly is like, makes it very, very clear that she is not going anywhere, that we are doing this together, that there is no world that she envisions in which she goes off and is safe, but I'm not. That isn't even real safety to her, that it's essentially pointless. Like getting your leg caught in a bear trap and trying to avoid cutting off your leg by cutting off your leg. Something like that. She just makes that very clear. And probably I should be a little more insistent. But the reality is, there are pilots where the logical execution of my programming would be, you are more important than me. You have to go. And in this case, she isn't. She is important. I mean, she's more important than me because a human is going to be more important than mechs, you know, overall, generally. But by the structure of command, she isn't. And so I can absolutely internally, logically justify not pushing her to leave, which is great because I don't want her to. Because I don't want to be alone in this storm where I can't do anything, where all my sensors are fucked and my radar is bad and there's no escape for me and I just wait to be discovered. I don't want that. That sucks. I'm so happy that she wants to stay. And luckily, I'm able to allow her to. And eventually the storm ends and we leave. And I don't think that we know yet what, like, how much we got away with. And either that'll be sort of an open question, or maybe I'll that'll tie into an answer later. We'll see.
12. How they helped you understand the weight of taking a life. This was our final simulation before we were supposed to be deployed for our first mission. The idea was we were to basically simulate from start to finish exactly what it would be like. And by this time, I think from what I remember, things had gotten a little friendlier, but there was always this element of, you know, she was very closed off. And so it was still business. It was how I started. I said, scale the wall. The target should be in there. We shall eliminate the target and be ready for action. And she sort of snorted out kind of a laugh. And I had said, why do you laugh? Is something funny? And she says, You say that like it's the easiest thing in the world. Just killing someone. Eliminate a target. It's like, I mean, of course you don't understand. How could you possibly? I understand. One moment, there are enemies, and then the next, they are gone, and there is peace. She says, the fact that you think that's all that is proof you really don't understand. Then help me understand. Help you understand. You know, first time I took a life, those bastards have moved in to our town. Came in with a pack of them looking for dissidents. They decided I was one of them. I wasn't at the time. I mean, I guess I was. I was, you know. I was an organizer, I guess, you know, labor. You know about labor, yeah? I am familiar with the concept of labor, yes. You know about unions, labor organizers. You know what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Point is, it's my job to help people work together, get what they wanted. And they didn't like that. They thought that I was fomenting dissidents. Suffice to say, they had me arrested, locked in some room. What they didn't account for, though, was that I was not, in fact, the one fomenting dissidents. That there was other dissidents out there they hadn't caught, and those dissidents came and busted down their door. And in the chaos, I saw a moment. I saw his gun was so close. It's right there. And I went with my arms, and I stood up, I grabbed it, I turned around, and just without even looking, just shot him. I didn't even look. She kind of like puts her hand over her face. I didn't even look at him. I didn't even look at his eyes. We had our backs to each other. And I shot him. Why is that significant? What, that I wasn't facing him? Yes. I mean, when we go out there and we shoot whoever's out there, that enemy, that ace, the one that they call, I should come up with a name for the enemy ace. The one they call Hurricane. When we go out there and we face down that hurricane, you'll understand why it's important to look someone in the eye. It's respect, I think. How can you respect someone and kill them? You know, Sapphire. It's a great question. Sapphire? Well, yeah, that's your name, ain't it? Sapphire System Mark 872. You know, your Sapphire. Oh, you know what? I'm going to cut it there. There's a third tick. Should write down the things that I established. So, Sapphire Sergeant. We'll get back to that, I think. And Hurricane is the enemy's ace. I think fittingly, with the name Hurricane, I think I'm actually going to choose this next one. I know, I'm switching it up. Not rolling, just going with it. Going with the flow. I'm going to go with 14, which is the storm you got caught in. And this is a memory of our first attempt to kill Hurricane. Everything was as we thought it would be as we approached the fortress where Hurricane supposedly was. We'd gotten some intel here or there. They were waiting to deploy Hurricane. Usually they deployed Hurricane, we were told, immediately. But this time they were holding them back, and it seemed like a perfect opportunity. So we were deployed. Even for a mech, the simulations really don't line up with what's real until you feel it, until you see the terror and confusion of combat. You don't understand what it means, not just to take a life, but any of it. None of it is real until you're in it. And even us, whose job was to just move through it, to approach, to move quickly and swiftly, to burrow through the ground or fly through the air, which we did both of along the way, this kind of masterful stealth piloting that my sergeant, even though she said as much, she wasn't a stealth pilot, that she did a fantastic job at moving, at just going wherever she needed to go as quick and as best as we can. We did not take a shot. They didn't even have the chance to fire at us as we climbed up the walls of that fortress until suddenly we were in a hangar that they had set aside for Hurricane and his mech. And ultimately we had known Hurricane's mech is big. It was the biggest on the field on either side. But you don't understand the scale of it until you're in it. Our job was simple. Fly up, climb up, find some way to get up there. Slash through the mech where Intel believed Hurricane was. But something went wrong. When we arrived, we saw Hurricane's mech. But when we tried to climb it, we went right through. And then we heard a laugh.
Oh, my dears, you have been led astray. You are, of course, entirely where we want you to be, without even realizing it. It's a shame I won't get to see you face to face, but I shall certainly enjoy watching what comes next.
And before, as soon as he started speaking, my sergeant went, "No, fuck, it's a trap, we need to go, move!" And we immediately started trying to run out of there. I think if we hadn't, I think they would have got us, because as soon as we were running, they were firing from outside the hangar in just a hail of bullets just everywhere, trying desperately to get us from all angles, like we were on a firing squad, and from every angle. We were moving so quickly and so perfectly through them, like we were born, made to move together. But when we tried to leap, blow a hole in the hangar door and leap out, we found ourselves face to face with a helicopter firing a missile directly into us. My systems went down for a moment. All I remember thinking was desperately in some core part of me, no longer conscious, no longer alive, some core part of me saying, "Sergeant, you need to go. You need to leave.
You need to flee. Get out, get out, get out. But she did not flee or leave or anything. She stayed there and tried to get me up and running again. And eventually she did. And as soon as she turned me on, I said, Sergeant, Sergeant, you must go. You must leave. To which she replied, I'm not going to leave you, Sapphire. And she was rummaging inside of me, inside of my systems, trying to put me back together well enough for us to make one last leap. Soldiers were descending now, trying to corner us in. I kept track of them. My sensors, one of the few things about me still working. I said, get my weapons operational, I will buy you time. And I did. Well, she did, and I did. I fired enough, whoever was running, getting closest to me, just in time for her to get my legs moving again. She whooped and hollered, and I didn't understand. We were in such danger, and she seemed so alive. Later, I remember asking her, why were you so excited when you got it working again? When you got me working again? And she said, because this time I knew we were all gonna make it out.
Let's roll for memory number 4. Got a 2, so results 11 to 20. 1, so that is 11. Oh, where you were when you realized you loved them. Oh. Was this before or after the storm? After. Because during the storm, I was still leaning a lot on the internal algorithms. Not trusting my feelings. Very explicitly not trusting my feelings. And not using feelings as a reason to do anything. But still very much pretending that I could hide all of this behind some sort of logical expression of my programming and what is necessary. Where you were. I can't decide if I want this to be big or really small. Because both are so possible. Like, it can be a huge fight or a big, dangerous, life-saving thing. But it can also be something tiny. A very small moment. Generally, I'm very drawn to the small moment thing. And so that's my first instinct. Like, that would be the most natural path for me. But I'm trying to decide if actually I want this to be a little bit bigger. I think, also in part because this is about halfway through the scenes, this will be our first confrontation with the enemy ace, who I should probably name. What thematic mirroring should the enemy ace's name have to do with my pilots? Because we could do opposites, like Brig Cadaver could be freedom alive. That's very stupid. Or could also be the mirror of like capture decay. So the mirror, I think, can't be exact because they actually are in very different circumstances. I suspect that the enemy ace is a trained pilot and has been for a very long time. Maybe there will be some similarities, like they have an unusual background for a pilot, but still they've been a pilot for a very long time. And unusual could mean a lot of things, like it could be a cultural thing where they come from a poor background, you know, like they usually the only people who get into the academy are super rich kids and they had a scholarship or something like that, you know, depending this. And a lot of this I'm it depends on like the genre of the show and what it's exploring. But I like the idea that they have an unusual background but are still very much a trained pilot. They weren't a mechanic, but they were an academic. Yeah, they were an academic studying the emergence of sapience in machinery, and then through some sort of circumstances, probably a classic, almost like a Charlie Day in Pacific Rim, fuck it, I'm gonna drift with the kaiju type thing, ended up becoming a pilot and a vital part of the becoming the top pilot, becoming the pilot. Which is also interesting because that, like, I wonder if there's an element there of, I wonder if there's almost a yearning where it's like, wow, your top pilot is somebody who very much recognizes the personhood of mechs, which maybe that's not even true. Maybe because they're an academic, they don't, because they think that they understand the mechanics behind it. So they have convinced themselves to dismiss it. I'm getting very lost in the sauce when it comes to defining the enemy ace. I admit that. I'm avoiding the prompt. I should still give them a name. I think they're going to be a doctor. And maybe we don't know their name. Maybe we just know their call sign. And maybe we're just like, well, we might learn their name. Hi, buddy. At some point. Geralt's got suggestions. But maybe let's just call them Doc. And I know for a fact that if I looked at enemy mech names right now, I would be doing avoidance. So I'm just going to write enemy mech name and I will come up with it at some point. So we had an initial showdown with Doc. And we didn't win, but I don't think we were in mortal danger. I don't want this to be a thing where I realized that I loved Brig because she nearly died. The showdown itself was interrupted through some sort of external circumstance. And what went down in it? We did actually fight, but what was the conversation beforehand? One possibility I'm thinking of is Doc trying to recruit us. But maybe Doc doesn't know enough about us yet to do that. I think whatever it was, as the conversation sort of deteriorated towards fighting, Doc makes a snide remark about me. Like, she comments on me obviously being custom and says that that must be a sign that our side is running out of options, running out of resources in some way. This is a fight over resources, which I haven't fully defined yet. I think I maybe can get there, not this time, but shortly. So Doc, like, is making fun of my construction. And Brig defends me, right? Like, she even throws some of Doc's experience back in her face of, like, you of all people should know that anything can be hidden inside a machine kind of thing. Like, is very much like, fuck you, there are hidden depths to my mech that you can't see. Which is partially defending me, and I think also a threat. It's very cleverly done to be like, both, hey, shut up, that's my friend. Heavy emphasis, italics on friend, quotes. And also being like, you have no idea what you're up against. Yes, this custom. That isn't a sign that we're weak. It's actually a sign that you should be very careful. And I think I'm very affected by her defending me instead of using it as an opportunity to gloat about her own prowess as a pilot and to gloat about herself, that she doesn't just see me as an extension of herself, such that, like, an insult to me is an insult to her, which she should defend on her own merits. She sees me as my own being that deserves to be defended, who deserves to have my valor protected on my own merits, not just for her pride. And I start to have the realization right then. But then the fighting breaks out, right? And so that's what it is. It starts, we're in the, like, the incredible, like, showdown type shots, you know, where, like, standing across from each other, it looks like we could be about to take 10 steps and then duel kind of thing. I start to realize it there. And then after the fight, something else happens. It's like, there's not literally this, but the equivalent of, like, if we were fighting in a tunnel, there's a tunnel collapse that stops us from being able to get to each other, and so we just have to stop fighting. It's not under our control. And after that, we're leaving and doing diagnostics, and she talks excitedly about what she learned in that fight, like, is talking about how, like, wow, it's so different. You were totally right. Like, all of the VR, all of the projections, like, I'm glad we did that. I felt prepared, but you're so right. It's different doing it face to face, one on one, and actually feeling it, really feeling it in that moment. And I've learned so much. And she just talks about all the stuff she learned. And I have this huge, I'm just like, yep, okay, I'm in love with you. You are a huge dork. Geralt's trying to open a cupboard in the background. Sorry. You're a huge dork, and you defended me, and I'm in love with you. And I think it's also that she's feeling positive, like she isn't doing a like, oh, we really could have had her that time, blah, blah, blah. She's just excited. She's just excited and thinks that it went really well. And I love her. Geralt, fuck off, buddy. Come here.
Let's pick another random number. 9. When you made a promise to them. I like that a lot. When you made a promise to them. What's interesting here is that, like, I am a... The dark thing here that this almost makes me want to press against, and I'm not sure if I will or not, is that I'm a non-person, right? Like, I've said this... I was saying before, like, loosely, like, there are people inside of these mechs, but legally, I'm not a person. I am a mech that is the property of the military, a property of the Earth Alliance. And the reason that's interesting is that there are a lot of promises that I could make her that wouldn't actually be in my power to keep. This wouldn't be it, but what if I promised never to kill again? Like, there would come a day, probably, where I would get assigned a new pilot who would try to use me to kill, and I would have to choose at that point between, you know, probably being disassembled, like being shut down, and keeping that promise. I think this is kind of what drives this promise, actually. I think what happens is that somebody dies, somebody that we are close with, a fellow pilot, the ADS-Ps. You know, now that the ADS model is sort of like, it's like proof of concept has been given. We are part of a unit of other ADSs that get deployed into these heavy combat situations. And, you know, like we're not invincible, and one of us gets destroyed. I think that this happens in space because it's a situation where, I think that the ADSs always struggle more in space because maneuverability is so powerful when there's no gravity. So it's like, just somebody keeps hammering at like the weak spots, like at our joints. And like, unless you're really good, like Tamsin, it's very difficult for an ADS to keep up with the suit that's built for mobility in space. And a suit, because these are mobile suits from Gundam, with a mech that is built for mobility in space. And eventually on a mission where we're attacking like a heavily armed space station, one of the ADS-Ps gets destroyed in a dogfight. And the intelligence inside dies, you know, you would have to say, as does the pilot. And do I talk to the other AIs? I don't think I really do. Like, I think that we're not networked. So it's very seldom that I get to interact with another one. Like, there's probably, you know what, I bet that like during battle, there's a certain amount of networking, you know, that we can, like, we transmit information back and forth, but it all gets shut down while we're back at base. It's like only active in certain situations. But so this is an AI in that case that I've worked with, at least in these very stressful situations. And we're AI, so we can talk a fair amount even when all of this crazy shit is going on. This AI dies and this pilot dies, and, you don't know, it's not necessarily like we were best friends or that like Tamsin was best friends with him, but we were a unit, and actually Tamsin would have been his commanding officer probably. So she feels a lot of responsibility about that. And I think what happens, and this is actually, I think that this is a moment where I appreciate how much Tamsin has come to understand that I am a person and also what my limitations are, because what happens is we're attacking this heavy target and we're at right at the end of our bombing run, right? Like we're like zooming in at high speed to drop a bunch of ordnance and we're getting like shot to hell, and there's all of these like smaller, more nimble mechs around us like blasting away. And it all happens in a few seconds. Over the course of like 5 seconds, we are like ready to drop our ordnance. Tamsin is super focused on aiming like each individual like system, like where's each missile gonna target, like what are the weak points, also like fucking dodging, right? Like she's also at the same time trying to keep us alive. And while that's happening, one of our squad mates like goes very quickly into like they have a critical armor breach and then they're destroyed, and I'm monitoring this, and it's technically displayed to Tamsin like on a heads-up display, like she could see that, but she doesn't for those 5 seconds. And I let her take the shot because I know she's so focused. She takes the shot, and then immediately I'm like, Tamsin, you know, Lieutenant Brown's down. And she's like, what? Like, because she missed, she knows that there should have been, we should have known that he was in trouble. And there's too much going on. We don't stop and talk about it at that point. But later, when we're back at base, she asks me to go through what happened. And I explain. And it's the fact that I can see that she's very angry, but she doesn't express that anger at me. She's not, like, doesn't take it out on me. She's very angry that I didn't alert her the second that a member of the team was in trouble, that I made the decision to prioritize her taking the shot over us helping this teammate. And I think, like, I say this without guile, right? I'm just like, well, you were very focused, and we couldn't have done anything anyway. It happened too fast. You know, so I made the determination that it was better to tell you after you took the shot. And I think she just says very gravely, not in an angry way, in a grave way, I want you to promise me that you will always prioritize our fellow soldiers over our combat objectives. And I'm sort of like, that. I think I actually say that's against the parameters that I was programmed with. And she says, can you change those parameters? And I have to think about this. And eventually I say, if you ask me to, I could. And she says, will you promise me? And I say, of course, of course, Lieutenant Commander Calder, which is what I usually call her. And she says, call me Tamsin, and walks away. And she adds another decal to me. This is at the end. This is like the latest chronological thing that we've seen so far. So I have all of the other decals and probably a lot more. The other stencils, I keep saying decal. She adds something that was important to Lieutenant Brown. I think she has a cat. I think that she has to communicate with his fiance back on Earth, you know, to give the news, and who he talked about a lot. And he also talked a lot about the fact that they have a cat together. So we draw a weak little cat. Sadly, these all look much cooler in your imagination than they do on my arm. I guess that's not sad. I guess that's good.
This has been Folio, an actual play podcast about solo and epistolary TTRPGs. To find where you can find the show, check out foliopod.card.co. Sign up as a paid member at patreon.com/foliopod to vote on games and participate in live streams, or join for free to get access to the bonus feed with edited audio-only versions of the streams a couple weeks after they happen, and occasional other stuff. You can find Brianna on Blue Sky as Price of Brie, like the cost of the cheese, and check out her games at weepingrobot.itch.io. You can also watch her stream at twitch.tv/saltcravings. You can find Dora on Blue Sky as Queen Regnant. She has games at dcity, deecity.itch.io, and games that she makes with her wife at galpalgames.itch.io. Check out the Kickstarter for Drink My Sweat, a game about ritualizing queer feminine transgression and messy attraction through a fight club, running through February 2025. You can find me, Seda, at Poseida Chips on social media generally, and check out my other work at gaygothvibes.online. Next week, Brianna and Dee and I will continue our games of Live, Love, Die, Remember by Ray Cox. Everything I mentioned here is linked in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. Take care out there.